This is day four of this April 2018 7-day session. And we'll return to a book called The Practice of Zen and resume reading from the story of Chinese Zen master Meng Shan, who lived in the mid-1200s. Left off yesterday with this remarkable recovery that he went through. He had severe dysentery and felt he was on the verge of death, and just committed himself to meditation, concentrating completely on Mu. There was nothing, just to review, there was nothing but the koan continuously presenting itself in my mind. And then first he felt he'd recovered halfway from his illness that night, and then they kept sitting until midnight, and then his recovery was complete. And ends by saying, both my body and my mind felt comfortable and light. I wanted to say a little bit more about this. We finished yesterday with my saying what a remarkable power that deep faith has. I can do things that empirical evidence can't back up. That sitting, he would have to have been sitting with such purity, such absolute single-minded devotion to Mu, that he couldn't have had any end in mind. I would suggest that he wasn't thinking, oh, I hope this works. I hope this works, gets me out of this. He was completely absorbed in Mu, with no thought about death or anything else. He wasn't trying to get anything. He wasn't using Mu to achieve something. He wasn't grasping at life. He was just doing Mu for its own sake. And also, even if he hadn't recovered, we know there are plenty of people who can pray or meditate with deep, deep devotion who still die. Even if he hadn't recovered, and we all have to die sooner or later, he would have died in the most serene kind of way, which would have set him up for a wonderful rebirth. So this one last thing about this faith, what comes to mind is this verse in the Mumon Khan, where Mumon says, rather than giving relief to the body, give relief to the mind. And that's what he was doing. He had exhausted whatever means he had in the 13th century, China, whatever means he had to recover physically, and he just turned it over to this mind that is beyond body and beyond our ordinary mind. He continues now with his story, his autobiography. In August, I went to Changning and joined the assembly of monks. There I remained in the monastery for 1 year. Then I joined the assembly of monks. There I remained in the monastery for 1 year. Then I started my pilgrimage. On this journey, I cooked my own food. Only then did I realize that the Zen task should be worked out at one stretch. It should never be interrupted. I'm not sure how that sentence follows from "on this journey I cook my own food," but the advice stands on its own. While you have the vitality and the vigor to practice seriously, keep it going. Later, I stayed at the Yellow Dragon Monastery. When I sat in meditation the first time, I became drowsy, but I alerted myself and overcame it. I felt drowsy a second time and alerted myself again to overcome it. When the drowsiness came for the third time, I felt very, very sleepy indeed. Then I got down and prostrated myself before Buddha, trying in different ways to pass the time. Here too, doing prostrations before a Buddha figure as a way to get the self out of it. And that's so often the cause of our tiredness is our thoughts about ourself and our progress or lack of progress or what we're going to do, or any number of thousands of different thoughts we can have about ourselves. This saps our energy. It's why, as Sashin moves along, there's this force that gathers in us, this energy, in spite of the fact that we have had less sleep than we're accustomed to. Doing prostrations would be a way to tap into this essential mind of ours that Mumon was referring to when he said, rather than giving relief to the body, give relief to the mind. But he continues, "I returned to my seat again. With everything arranged, I decided to surmount my drowsiness once and for all. First, I slept for a short while with a pillow, then with my head on my arm. Next, I dozed without lying down. For two or three nights, I struggled on in this way, feeling sleepy all day and evening. My feet seemed not to be standing on the ground, but floating in the air. Then suddenly the dark clouds before my eyes opened. My whole body felt comfortable and light, as if I had just had a warm bath. Meanwhile, the doubt sensation in my mind became more and more intensified. Without effort, it automatically and incessantly appeared before me. Neither sounds, views, nor desires and cravings could penetrate my mind. It was like the clear sky of autumn, or like pure snow filling a silver cup. Then I thought to myself, this is all very well, but no one here can give me advice or resolve these things for me. Whereupon, I left the monastery and went to Che Chiang. On the way, I suffered great hardships, so that my work was retarded. On arrival, I stayed with Master Ku Chan of Chin Tien, and made a vow that I would attain enlightenment or never leave the monastery. After meditation for 1 month, I regained the work lost on the journey. But meanwhile, my whole body became covered with growing boils. These I ignored and stressed my work, even to the point of disregarding my own life. In this way, I could work better and gain more improvement. Thus, I learned how to work in sickness. One day, I was invited out for dinner. This would be a way for, if he was invited by one of the lay supporters of the monastery, it would be a way for that person to gain merit You know, when you treat a monk to dinner. On my way, I took up the koan and worked at it, and thereby, without realizing it, I passed my host's house. Thus I learned how to keep up my work and activity. When I reached this state, the feeling was like the moon in the water, transparent and penetrating, impossible to disperse or obliterate by rolling surges. It was inspiring, alive, and vivid all the time. It's a nice image, the reflection of the moon in the water. Doesn't matter how rough the surface is, about the waves, there it is still, shining there in the water. On the 6th of March, while I was meditating on the Wu word, Mu, the head monk came into the hall to burn incense. He struck the incense box, making a noise. Suddenly and abruptly, I recognized myself and caught and defeated Zhao Zhou. That's the Chinese master who said Mu or Wu. Whereupon I composed this stanza. In despair, I reached the dead end of the road. I stamped upon the wave, but it was only water. Oh, that outstanding only Zhao Zhou. His face is as plain as this. This is what we realize when we realize Mu is the plainness, the utter ordinariness and clarity and simplicity of it, radical simplicity of it. Nothing complicated. We see that it's all around us, and we ourselves are this Mu, that there's nothing outside this Mu, nothing outside our true nature. In the autumn, I consulted Wanshan, Master Wanshan, who asked me, isn't the saying, and then he quotes the saying, the glowing light shines serenely over the river sands, a prosaic remark by that foolish scholar Chang? He was setting him up there, luring him into, and Meng says, I was just about to answer when Master Shan shouted at me, get out! From that moment, I was not interested in anything. I felt insipid and dull at all times and in all activities. We can see that reaching the remarkable degree of enlightenment that this monk eventually did reach is not just a straight line of progress. There are deep experiences he has, and then there are these setbacks, and then he overcomes those and so on until he comes out. He prevails over all of these obstacles that are presented by karmic obstructions that can exist after awakening. Six months passed. One day in the spring of the next year, I came back to the city from a journey. While climbing some stone steps, I suddenly felt all the doubts and obstacles that were weighing me down melt away like thawing ice. I did not feel that I was walking the road with a physical body. Immediately I went to see Master Shan. He asked me the same question that he had put before. In answer, I just turned his bed upside down onto the ground. Thus, one by one, I understood some of the most obscure and misleading koans. Friends, if you want to practice Zen, you must be extremely earnest and careful. If I had not caught dysentery in Chongqing, I would probably have frittered my whole life away. Yeah, it's after we find our way through crises that we can sometimes look back and see that it was just what we needed. I'm going to turn now to another part of this book called The Discourses of Master Po Shan. Again, there's no date given. Not that it matters so much, but I'm guessing from few things in this book that it was, well, in the teens somewhere, maybe the 1500s. When working on Zen, the important thing is to generate the doubt sensation. What is this doubt sensation? For instance, where did I come from before my birth, and where shall I go after my death? Since one does not know the answer to either question, a strong feeling of doubt or perplexity arises in the mind. Well, it does for some people. There are many people who have these occasional thoughts about these existential questions about life and death, suffering, who they are, where they came from, where they're going. But then they don't stick. They get caught up in all kinds of busyness, and they remain unaddressed, these big questions. But if they do stick, he says, a strong feeling of doubt or perplexity arises in the mind. Take hold of this doubt mass and keep it there all the time until you can neither drive it away nor put it down, even if you wanted to. Then suddenly you will discover that the doubt mass has been crushed, that you have broken it into pieces. The masters of old said, the greater the doubt, the greater the awakening. The smaller the doubt, the smaller the awakening. No doubt, no awakening. As anyone can learn from the Three Pillars of Zen, this doubt or perplexity is the flip side of faith. So if we have faith that in our essential nature we have this boundless wisdom and compassion and virtue, if we have faith that that is our nature, then from that arises perplexity as to why it is that we can't live out of that, how it is that with that as our essential nature, we conduct ourselves in our lives in any way but that, or that we keep tripping up. That's one example of faith and doubt as two sides of one coin. Another would be, say, with a koan mu, is if you have faith that in your inherent nature you're not apart from mu. Mu is your true self, beyond this, way beyond this limited self. Then why is it that we still feel at odds from it? Why does it seem like an object apart from us, hanging out there, this external thing that we can't seem to merge with? That's the doubt part. What is it? we believe we are Mu, then how come we can't present it and demonstrate it? He continues, when working on Zen, the worst thing is to become attached to quietness, because this will unknowingly cause you to be engrossed in dead stillness. Then you will develop an inordinate fondness for quietness and at the same time an aversion to activity of any kind. This is the always the threat in Sesshin, is that especially about the middle of Sesshin and then on later into the rest of Sesshin, one can settle into a kind of a calm, a wonderful calm, and want to just dwell there and not make the effort to break through and get beyond that calm. It takes a real commitment to one's practice, a real aspiration to not want to settle for that settled state. I think for many of us, it's just so delicious to settle into that calm and have time pass and to savor it as something that we never get a chance to really appreciate in that way outside of Sesshin. We may do that. We may kind of coast or settle into that calm for Sesshin after Sesshin after Sesshin until maybe, hopefully, we realize that's not going to do it. Calm doesn't resolve fundamental questions. We have to press through that state of tranquility. We do that by questioning. Or if not questioning, at least pressing on, looking deeply into Mu or whatever one's practice is. He continues, once those who have lived amidst the noise and restlessness of worldly affairs experience the joy of quietness, they become captivated by its honey-sweet taste, craving it like an exhausted traveler who seeks a peaceful den in which to slumber. How can people with such an attitude retain their awareness? This is where the stick can really help lift you out of that state of tranquility, of sort of, or what he's calling dead calm, dead stillness. It's a tremendous aid or spur to practice to prevent complacency. He continues, when working on Zen, one does not see the sky when he lifts his head, nor the earth when he lowers it. He's talking about a very particular and deep state of samadhi. To him, a mountain is not a mountain, and water is not water. While walking or sitting, he is not aware of doing so. Though among 100,000 people, he sees no one. Without and within his body and mind, nothing exists but the burden of his doubt sensation. This feeling can be described as turning the whole world into a muddy vortex. This, by the way, is a very unusual state. Few people ever get into this state, much less stay there very long. But you don't have to have this experience this state exactly in order to have an initial awakening. He continues, a Zen practitioner should resolutely vow that he will never stop working until this doubt mass is broken up. This is a most crucial point. What does this turning the whole world into a muddy vortex mean? It refers to the great truth, which from the very no beginning time has existed latent and idle. It has never been brought forth. Therefore, a Zen practitioner should bestir himself to make the heavens spin and the earth and its waters roll. Again, to press on and dynamically without sinking into this calm. He will greatly benefit from the rolling surges and tossing waves. This he says, the great truth, which from the very no beginning time has existed latent and idle. Every one of us is endowed with this truth, this self nature, this Dharma, really, this Buddha nature. Every one of us equally endowed with it. What we have to do is bring it forth, that is to allow it to come into consciousness, to manifest itself in our life. That's the challenge. It's one thing to have this intrinsically pure Buddha nature. It's quite a different thing to be able to live out of it, to respond, to act and speak out of this true nature. That's where practice comes in, of course. He continues, when working on Zen, if one brings forth the doubt sensation, he is in accord with the principle of the Dharmakaya. He may possibly then consider the Dharmakaya as something supernatural. With this notion in mind, he begins to see lights, auras, and all sorts of different visions. He believes these to be holy revelations, and with great pride begins to tell people about them, claiming that he has attained the great enlightenment. Well, we know of this danger, what the Japanese call makyo, or these exotic states of mind that are really side effects of strong sitting, and we all know not to get snagged in these states, but to see them as transitory phenomena that we don't want to linger in. He says, one who is truly working on Zen has no time for illusory visions or even for a second thought, not though a sharp knife be pressed against his throat. If one's experience really conforms to the truth, he realizes there is no object outside of his own mind. Can he find a vision apart from the mind which mirrors it? In other words, to see when these sorts of things, maybe not quite so dramatically, but when these illusory phenomena happen, these hallucinations or other things, to remind oneself that they're all just projections of one's own mind, and not to become bewitched by these things. When working on Zen, one should not worry about not being able to revive after death. What should worry him is whether he can die out from the state of life. if one can really wrap himself up tightly in the doubt mass, the realm of movement will be vanquished naturally without his making any specific effort to vanquish it. And one's distracted thoughts will be purified spontaneously without effort to purify them. This is a fundamental point that one has to understand sooner or later, that we don't have to do anything about our thoughts. We don't have to go about a project of purifying our thoughts or even ridding ourselves of our thoughts. But rather, it's just through this devoted absorption in the practice we're working on, the koan, the breath, whatever it is, by doing that, the thoughts settle. The mind is purified. We're not doing it. We don't have to do this. We turn it over to the practice we're working on. Our breath, the mu, or whatever koan we're working on, is our agent. It does it for us. If we can just surrender everything to the practice we're working on. The thoughts, that's not our project. When working on Zen, one should concentrate on one koan only and not try to understand or explain them all. Certainly not explain them all. So one at a time. Even if one were able to do so, this would be merely intellectual understanding and not true realization. The Lotus Sutra says, the Dharma is not comprehended through thinking and intellection. This is another very important point about practice when you're working on a koan, is to not imagine for a minute that you can figure it out. No one has ever figured out mu, or what is this, or who am I. We don't have to figure it out. We have to unite with it, be completely one with it. And then understanding arises from that. It's not working with the head. It's not working with our ordinary brain. It's uniting with it. He quotes another sutra that says, to perceive the realm of enlightenment of the Tathagata with the thinking mind is like attempting to burn Mount Sumeru with the light of a firefly. Never will one succeed. Mount Sumeru is this mythical mountain that's supposed to be at the center of the universe. Big, let's just say big. When working on Zen, she who works with absorption will feel as if she had lifted a 1,000-pound load. And even if she wants to put it down, she cannot do so. This is when the koan has really got a grip on you. It's a very promising state. In ancient times, people would enter into dhyana, let's say absorption, while tilling the land, picking peaches, or engaging in any business. It was never a matter of sitting idly for prolonged periods, engaged in forcefully suppressing one's thoughts. Does dhyana mean stopping one's thoughts? If so, this is a debased dhyana, not the dhyana of Zen. When working on Zen, the most harmful thing is to rationalize, conceptualize, or intellectualize the Tao with one's mind. If one does so, he will never reach the Tao. Here, this is easier said than done. Avoiding this is easier said than done, because so much of our conceptualizing we're not aware of as we're doing it. We are so habituated to working the mind, so habituated to dwelling in our thoughts, that very often when we're doing it, we're unaware of it. That's it. Maybe the biggest challenge is the noticing when we're doing it. He continues, when working on Zen, one should not just await the coming of enlightenment with an expectant mind. This is like one on a journey who sits idly by the road and expects his home to come to him. He will never arrive home this way. To get there, he must walk home. Likewise, when working on Zen, one never reaches enlightenment merely by waiting for it. He must press forward with all his mind to get this enlightenment. Attainment of the great enlightenment is like the sudden blossoming of the lotus flower or the sudden awakening of the dreamer. One cannot, by waiting, awaken from a dream, but he does so automatically when the time for sleep is over. Flowers cannot bloom by waiting, but blossom of themselves when the time has come. Likewise, enlightenment is not so attained, but comes on its own when conditions are ripe. In other words, one should exert all his strength to penetrate into the koan, pressing his mind to the utmost in order to achieve realization. Do not misunderstand what I have said and just wait for awakening to come. In the moment of awakening, the clouds vanish and the clear sky shines, vast and empty. Nothing can obscure it. In this moment, heaven spins and the earth somersaults. An entirely different realm appears. There are a couple of phrases here the translator gives us that could be misleading. This phrase, pressing his mind to the utmost in order to achieve realization. It kind of sounds like having that as your goal in mind, and that will never work. It's not in order to. We pour ourselves into the koan or the breath for its own sake. That's the key. Again, this is so important. As long as we see the practice we're working on as a means to an end, as a tool to get us somewhere, then we won't get there. We have to give up, let go of any thought of the future, of getting, and just devote ourselves to the practice, just the practice, for its own sake. It's difficult. It takes most of us a lot of practice purifying the mind of this acquisitive agenda before we can do that, before we can forget about getting anything and just unite, merge with the practice for its own sake. And always what's driving this is our innate longing to complete ourselves, our Buddha seed, this seed that we have always had within us to realize our true nature. somewhere in one of Roshi Kapil's books, he writes that we have all taken this great vow. It's the same vow that an acorn takes to become a towering oak tree, or that a peach stone takes to become a peach tree, or that an infant takes to become an adult. It's how we're wired. We come to practice to facilitate that. Dylan Thomas somewhere refers to the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. We all have that force. Don't doubt it. We need only to get ourselves out of the way, which means stop clinging to our thoughts, and that force will move mountains. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind measures. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain. All beings without number, I bow to break endless blind measures. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain. All beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha.